It's hard for me to believe that I've been in practice here in Sarasota now for nearly 24 years. And in that period of time, the health of America has very much changed. And it has actually since I got involved with health. Because a ways back when I got involved, because I was very ill, we didn't have the obese America that we have today. And when I looked at the current statistics that were just released, that 72% plus of men are overweight and 64% of women are overweight at this point. And 32% of men and 35% of women are obese. It's astounding. At the point we are now, there are 8.5% of the adult population that have grade 2 obesity and 5.7% of the population that has grade 3 obesity. These are measurements of your body mass index. Suffice it to say, some of us are a little fluffy and some of us are a lot fluffier. But what's really shocking to me is that 31% of children between 2 and 19 are overweight, and 17% of them are obese. Obese children and adolescents are much more likely to become obese as adults. Now, why would I want to start talking about that just less than 2 weeks before Christmas? Because a lot of people that weren't obese before the Christmas holidays become obese during the Christmas holidays. Somehow it gives us the liberty to stuff our face. We eat more candy and more junk and more cookies and more eggnog and more this and more that during this holiday season than we do any other time of the year. And when we're dealing with this incredible prevalence of metabolic syndrome happening in America today, it's important that we talk about risk factor reduction. And it's important that we talk about it right now before people go hell-bent for leather in the holiday season stuffing their face. You know, if obese children and adolescents are more likely to become obese as adults, actually 80% of them. If a kid is overweight between 10 and 15 years of age, they're 80% likely that they're going to be obese adults at 25 years of age. If their overweight happens before they're 8 years old, then obesity in adulthood is likely to be more severe and above 90%. So we see these wonderful success stories of people who have lost a lot of weight. But, you know, the pathophysiology of obesity is very complex and it has lots of factors in it. And we still have a tendency to look at people that are overweight and just think they're lazy or they're gluttonous. But in fact, what we're doing is missing out on the health consequences that are coming from our dietary habits and how food chemists have changed our food over the last 40 years. I remember a client that said to me one time, you know, I think that the food chemists, I don't know that she used that particular term, but, you know, the people that make and manufacture food design food to become addictive. And you know what? She was absolutely right. Food chemists pride themselves on their ability to make an incredible cocktail of sugar and fat and salt and flavors that make us want it, that turn on the parts of our brain that make us want to overeat. And so when we realize that 60% of these overweight children, especially in the 5 to 10 year of age, had a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, 15% of overweight children have two or more risk factors for cardiovascular disease before they're 10 years old. You know, this is the very first time in the history of the world that children born today may have a shorter life expectancy than that of their parents and their grandparents. What's even more tragic is that the health expectancy. Now, health expectancy is the number of years that you live in good health. It's the number of quality years. it's likely to be less for today's children than it is for their parents and their grandparents. That is so wrong. You know, the current pediatric obesity epidemic, we're seeing conditions in kids that used to be considered adult health problems, just like type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes now accounts for 45% of all newly diagnosed diabetes in pediatric patients, and it was less than 20 years ago that we saw type 2 diabetes in a teenager for the first time. Now we're seeing it in kids that only have one number in their age. And you can tell it. You know, I told this story before that I served on the Sarasota County Science Advisory Commission for about 5 years. And really a remarkable experience that I had. And they brought a fancy schmancy expert on childhood obesity down from Washington, D.C. And she had her charts and her PowerPoints and her laser pointer and all of her factoids. And she put a chart up on the PowerPoint that showed the kids' height and weight and gave us this very complicated equation of how you multiply their height by this number and how you multiply their weight by this number and you divide this into that. And that was what was going to tell you whether this child was obese. And I said, well, you know, I had studied with an expert on childhood obesity, and they said, you look at the kid and the kid looks fat, the kid is fat. And they never invited me back to another meeting. So the importance of abdominal obesity is really where we're going here. If you look at a kid and a kid's got a belly more than they should have, if a kid's got a double chin, you don't need no freaking chart. We know that abdominal obesity is more strongly associated with disease risk than body mass index is alone. Anytime we find a man with a waistline over 40 inches and a woman with a waistline over 35 inches, doesn't matter even how tall they are, we know it predicts a greater risk for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. That abdominal obesity is linked with insulin resistance, with hyperinsulinemia, with hyperglycemia, with abnormalities in cholesterol, high blood pressure, inflammation. And it is this abdominal obesity that really is the flag. You know, you got two kinds of fat. You got subcutaneous fat, which is the fat that's right under your skin. And then you've got visceral fat, the part that's beneath the abdominal muscles that surrounds the internal organs. And it is the excess of visceral fat that plays a much more important role in terms of the pathogenic role. When we look at insulin resistance, what is it? The cell can't use sugar correctly anymore. And fundamentally, the cell can't use sugar effectively because the membrane of the cell has changed. And what is astounding to me in my practice today is that I will get clients that come in that have normal weight, but they have an metabolically, they're altered already. They have adverse metabolic profiles. And so we call them metabolically obese normal weight. They're metabolically obese, and yet what it says on the scale is fine, and you tell right away because as soon as you squeeze their arm, they feel squishy. We're not supposed to feel squishy. We're not supposed to feel like we're grabbing a marshmallow. There's supposed to be muscle under there. So when we look at the difference between people who are fleshy but have great metabolism, we don't all have to be the perfect weight. We have assigned in this country the idea that thin is healthy automatically. And yet I see metabolically normal obese people, just like I see metabolically obese normal weight. And so metabolically normal, there can be people that are overweight and yet they're still fit. So when we begin to look at the individuals well, I'll just talk in my practice, you know, that come in and they get liposuction done. They get that fat sucked out. What they suck out is subcutaneous fat. It's not visceral fat. It's not the fat that's underneath the muscle around the organs. And so it doesn't really change their blood profiles very much. And in fact, now we know that liposuction that's done to get rid of love handles or to get rid of a belly, that that person generally gains that weight again in the upper part of the back. And so you've seen women, especially with that triangle upper back where there's too much fat right underneath the armpit area, and that will follow a couple of years after the liposuction is done. So liposuction doesn't solve that problem. And so when we look at the nature of this insulin resistance, what we're trying to do is to figure out what can cause it. What sets us up for insulin resistance? And a very big part of it I talked about last week when I talked about the use of high fructose corn syrup being 40% of all the sweeteners that we have in this country. High fructose corn syrup is metabolized completely differently than regular sugar is. Regular sugar requires an insulin response. High fructose corn syrup does not require insulin. It goes directly to the liver and it's metabolized by the liver. And so what we see is individuals who are drinking their calories. Now, it doesn't matter whether they're drinking their calories from any sources, but soda pop is obviously the worst of the bunch. But whether it's soda pop or whether it's beer, whether it's soy milk or whether it's almond milk, whether it's fruit juice or whether it's wine, it appears that the calories that we drink have way more to do with creating insulin resistance than any other single food. Now, we know that there are other causes. We know that a sedentary lifestyle contributes, that smoking contributes, that chronic stress contributes. And we know there's certain drugs, whether they're protease inhibitors or thiazide diuretics or beta blockers or corticosteroids, all of those things can be related to creating insulin resistance. But when these visceral fat cells start to enlarge, they become dysfunctional, they become stressed, they become inflamed, and they become resistant to insulin. And as your pancreas, that miraculous organ that sits over there to the left of your stomach above your belly button, that organ produces hormones like insulin and glucagon, and it produces enzymes, pancreatic enzymes that help you digest your food. And when that insulin shows up at the cell, these cells can't get the sugar in correctly, and insulin goes up and goes up and goes up to try to jam the sugar into the cell. And we create these dysfunctional fat cells. See, we always thought that fat just sat there. It was just padding. It was padding to sit on, padding in your belly, padding on your hips. But in fact, it doesn't just sit there. When there's enough fat in the belly, it actually becomes an organ. Wow, think about that. The fat in your body acts as an organ. And it begins to release fatty acids into the circulation. And these fats accumulate in various tissue, the muscle tissue, the liver tissue, in the pancreas itself, and creates lipotoxicity, fat toxicity. We want to understand that fat cells actually secrete inflammatory compounds. And those inflammatory compounds can be felt all over the body. Maybe they make your muscles hurt. Maybe they make your joints hurt. Maybe they give you a headache. Maybe they just make you feel lousy. But it comes from the insulin resistance. You know, normally insulin favors the glucose uptake. But when the liver becomes resistant to insulin, then there is increased glucose production. And the liver starts to accumulate fat. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is showing up even in 10-year-olds now. And then it sends more triglycerides out into the blood. High blood triglycerides are a reflection of insulin resistance in both the fat and in the liver tissue. So anytime we see high blood triglycerides, we are seeing a situation where the body is not using fuel correctly. You thought that was bad news? Well, it gets worse. It gets worse because the endothelium, which is the lining of the layer of cells that goes lines all of your blood vessels, from the heart all the way down to the smallest capillary in your body. You know, you have capillaries in your body that are way smaller than a human hair. You have capillaries in your body that are so small, red blood cells have to turn sideways to wiggle through them. Well, these endothelial cells are important not just because they provide a physical lining, but because they secrete factors that are critical for normal blood vessel biology. They make something called NO, nitric oxide, that improve the tone of the vessel. And so insulin resistance becomes a concern because it creates a state of endothelial inflammation, of endothelial dysfunction. And then the endothelium starts secreting substances that promote plaque to build up, as opposed to keeping the lining of those arteries slick like Teflon. This is one of the reasons that diabetes speeds heart disease by about 400%. But now we know that this insulin resistance even affects the brain. It affects appetite. It affects body weight regulation. It affects memory and cognition. They're even talking about changing the name of Alzheimer's to type 3 diabetes, because we know now that the brain can become resistant to insulin. When we look at the dysregulation in the brain, when we look at the fact that the brain can't make enough energy, if the brain can't make enough energy, we can't remember. So what we find out here is that this visceral fat, this fat that we accumulate in our abdomen underneath the muscles, insulin resistance, go together and create chronic disease. And the chronic disease that gets created is fundamentally diabetes. And what goes with diabetes is heart disease. You know, I had a client in my practice just this last week who said, you know, I was pre-diabetic for a number of years. And I went, there's no such thing as pre-diabetes. Pre-diabetes is like saying you're sort of pregnant. You is or you isn't. You're diabetic or you're not. But what we want to understand is that cardiovascular disease kills 80% of all the people that have diabetes. You know, that's a heart disease death rate that's 4 times higher than adults without diabetes. There's 4 times higher risk of stroke in individuals who have diabetes. And this so-called pre-diabetes, you've still got twice the risk of cardiovascular disease. The clock starts ticking years before the onset of clinical diabetes, that the body is starting to change. And so I come back and talk about kids, because I know a lot of you holistic moms listen to this show, and you're out there trying to feed your babies well. If your child was born after the year 2000, we're in a situation now that 1/3 of boys and 39% of girls, all the children born after the year 2000, are going to develop diabetes in their lifetime. And if we're talking about African Americans, it goes up to 40% of males and 45% of females. By the time we're talking about a Hispanic population, we're talking about 53% of females born in 2000 will develop diabetes. This is astounding. You know, they're in Washington blathering back and forth with their little brat attacks up there in the Congress, trying to do nothing but revamp the insurance system. They still haven't done a damn thing about health care. There is no health care system in America. There's a disease care system in America. And if you hear the anger come forward in my voice, it's because nobody ever talks about the stuff that really makes a difference. You know, the fact that they voted down the improvements in the school lunch program shows you just how retarded Washington is now. Because how in heaven's name are you going to entrust a child with the responsibility of choosing well in a lunch line when their choices include pizza and french fries. Hello? We have no business entrusting a child with that responsibility. I grew up in Pinellas County, and when I went to school, what got slopped on your plate on that lunch line is what you got. You didn't get a choice. So when we look at the risk for our youth, these are pretty dire projections. A third of boys and 39% of girls born from the year 2000 on will develop diabetes in their lifetime. Moms, we can't let our kids gain weight. And the way that we keep them from gaining weight is making sure that fruits and vegetables are their first choice and taking out the sweetened beverages, all the SSBs, all the sugar sweetened beverages. You know, I see people, they drink this iced tea in a can, a great big, huge, tall can. You could stand on it to put your Christmas lights up. And they don't realize there's 2.5 servings of tea in that tall can and 300 calories of sweetener. 300 calories in a week, 2,100 calories in a month, almost 9,000 calories coming from sweetener. But people somehow think that in drinking that can of iced tea, they're doing a better job than drinking a can of pop. And what's true is they are, but it's not a much better job. And so when we look at all of the population of those of you that are listening, and we ask, how many of you are physically inactive? You know, there's no single thing that is a bigger youth treatment, a bigger preventative of disability in old age than fitness. So you can call it exercise, you can call it activity, you can call it fitness, but what it means is we have to move. We have human bodies that are designed to move. 100 years ago, our grandparents and great-grandparents were living an agrarian lifestyle. They were living on a farm for the most part, and they were slopping the hogs and feeding the chickens and milking the cows and throwing the hay up in the loft, and they were physically active. They walked places. And so we need to move. Whatever it is that you need to do. You know, I've said before, I don't do well in gym. A gym is not a good environment for me. But the quiet morning is. I can get out of bed, feed the animals, open the blinds, put the teapot on, and walk out the door. And knock down that walk before I get in the shower. That isn't my husband's rhythm. My husband can leave his desk at 5 o'clock with his gym bag and go out and work out with the other muscle heads at the gym. That's not my rhythm. So you have to find your rhythm. But moving, there's no single thing that protects us more against dementia than moving. There's no single thing that protects us more against diabetes and heart disease than moving. There's no single thing that protects us more from being put into a nursing home than moving. Frailty is still the single biggest reason that women are admitted to a nursing home in the state of Florida. And since there's 5 times as many women in nursing homes as there are men, that's the reason that I emphasize that. Well, what happens? What happens in the complication of diabetes? Well, the first thing is blood pressure goes up. And people are not assertive enough. Even doctors are not assertive enough in controlling blood pressure. Well, there's an easy way to get off blood pressure medication. When I have clients that come into my office and they say, oh, I'm on these drugs and I don't really want to be on these drugs. Well, just up the amount of fruits and vegetables that you eat. Increase the amount of lean meat. Get out the fatty meat. Take the salt shaker off the table. Stop using the processed and prepared foods. And you'll be off that blood pressure medication in 8 to 12 weeks. Just type in DASH diet, D-A-S-H. And that DASH diet alone is enough to eliminate hypertensive medication in at least 50% of the people that actually follow it. When we look at any of the dietary interventions to stop hypertension, which is essentially what the DASH diet is, We see the very same dietary recommendations that are beneficial to all sorts of conditions of health. And so my real question to you is, what kind of old person do you want to be? You know, it's never, you are never too young to decide what kind of old person you're going to be. And moms, you need to hear this for your kids. You're deciding now what kind of old person your kids are going to be. I can't imagine anybody who's wanting to put a deposit into their kids' college account every month to make sure they get a college education, but at the same time are feeding them a diet that's going to turn them into a diabetic. Hello? When we look at the nature of cognitive decline alone, you know, I've done a number of shows about this. With one out of two people at age 85 having Alzheimer's, one out of five at age 70, they're talking about now, because the number of people 65 and older are increasing in our population, they're talking about Alzheimer's disease doubling over the next 40 years to 20% of the population. The prevalence of those 85 and older that have Alzheimer's is expected to rise to 19 million people. And what we know is central obesity, fat around the middle, especially in your midlife, especially all through your 40s, is linked to an increased risk of future dementia. Insulin is readily transported into the central nervous system across the blood-brain barrier. There is a very high concentration of insulin receptors in the hippocampus. The hippocampus is your memory center. So we know that insulin plays a critical role in memory. And important functions of that brain insulin are disrupted in the presence of insulin resistance. Individuals with dementia have 1.5 times the increased risk of cognitive decline and dementia, both from Alzheimer's disease and from vascular dementia. So you want to keep your brain working? You want to make sure that your sugars are controlled. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have a piece of cake. It doesn't mean you can't have a candy cane, but why would you want to? You've eaten enough candy canes before in your life, haven't you? Don't you know what they taste like? Have a cup of mint tea. At least that'll improve your digestion. So when we look at the changes that happen, what we actually see is these things called microvalvular changes. Little teeny tiny blood vessels. Little teeny tiny blood vessels in your feet, in your eyes, in your kidney, in your heart. Those are the things that get damaged. And that's the reason that atherosclerosis, that progressive degenerative disease of the vasculature, can affect any artery in the body, not just the arteries in your heart, but the arteries in your brains and your arms and your legs and your pelvis. So whether we end up with coronary heart disease or carotid artery disease or peripheral arterial disease, it's all the same thing. They're collectively, all those conditions come under the cardiovascular disease heading. We already have 1 in 3 people in America that have some type of cardiovascular disease. Now, we know mortality from cardiovascular disease has decreased over the last 40 years because we've got way better treatment. We've got way better control of risk factors. We're using antihypertensive drugs and statin drugs and anti-smoking legislation. All of those things have helped, but cardiovascular disease is still the leading cause of death and disability in the United States. And it looks right now like all of that progress is going to be wiped out by this combination of diabetes and obesity, what's called cardiodiabesity. Cardiodiabesity is going to be language that you're going to hear more commonly in the popular press in the coming years. You know, we always thought that atherosclerosis was a man's disease. The reality is that it's heart disease, and it's the leading killer of women in the United States, but affects women differently and at different times in their lives than men. Before menopause, women suffer much less from heart disease than men of the same age. But after menopause, the gap closes until women become more likely than men to suffer from heart disease. It's often undiagnosed because their symptoms are different. When we realize that cardiovascular disease is often silent, you know, 50% of the men who die suddenly from cardiovascular. I talked to a client on Saturday who lost her husband last September. No previous symptoms whatsoever. Bang, gone. No warning. Face down on the sidewalk. No warning whatsoever. 50% of men. 64% of women who die suddenly from cardiovascular disease have no previous symptoms. That's why when I meet these people who say, I hate doctors. I hate doctors. I don't want to go to doctors. You know, just those simple screening techniques of blood pressure and getting your blood work done, where we get a panel of your metabolic markers and a CBC, a complete blood count, they can often give us information that can allow us to change behaviors now before a disease happens. We can do something about overweight. We can do something about high blood pressure. We can do something about abnormalities of our cholesterol and fats. We can do something about smoking. You know, the toxic effects of long-term tobacco health, tobacco smoking to health are astounding. You knew that. You know, people who smoke one pack of cigarettes a day are twice as likely to experience a heart attack or stroke compared with non-smokers of the same age. Twice as likely. The good news is that within 12 to 18 months after you stop smoking, most of the increased cardiovascular risk disappears. And by the time you get to 5 years, the risk of cardiovascular events is no different than that of a non-smoker. But 23% of men continue to smoke, and almost 20% of women continue to smoke. And if we stop and test 50% of all the people walking down the street in Sarasota that are non-smoking, we're still going to find in their blood evidence of exposure to secondhand smoke. We're going to find it in children, too. They tested a group of kids in the school, and they found out 60% of children that were 4 to 11 years old had metabolites of cigarette smoke in their blood. So heart disease is largely modifiable. That's not the case with other things that we have that affect us. But when we look at these modifiable factors, from smoking to hypertension, from poor lipid results on your blood test to physical inactivity, from poor diet to stress, it's the synergy of all of these things together that multiplies the risk. And so, risk reduction. I had a client that came into me a couple of weeks ago. And she had been out to one of the local steakhouses. And she had ordered the New York strip, which is one of the single fattiest cuts you can buy. Remember, anytime you're eating a four-legged animal, you want to eat only cuts that have the word loin or round in the name. Eye round, top round, bottom round, sirloin, tenderloin. If it's got the word loin or round in the name, you know it's the leanest. So she had New York strip steak. And she said, oh, it was her birthday. She was celebrating. Yeah, this is a great way to celebrate, clog up your heart. So, you know, 3.5 ounces is the amount that you measure in nutrition. It's 100 grams. And so all the studies, when you measure, it doesn't matter whether you're measuring peanuts or green beans, you measure 100 grams of it to get your numbers. So 100 grams of white meat chicken breast has 3.1 grams of fat in it. 100 grams of New York strip steak has 37 grams of fat in it. 3, 37, this isn't hard. more than 12 times the amount of fat that you have in chicken. Now, who the heck eats 3.5 ounces of New York strip? Of course not. It was a 10-ounce New York strip. So she's essentially eating 3 times 37 grams of fat. And I said, what did you have with the meal? And she said, a baked potato. I said, what'd you put on it? She said, butter and sour cream and bacon bits. Okay, there's another big old wad of lard on there. And what did you have for dessert? She had, get ready, cheesecake. And so I did the math and I figured out that she had had 200 grams of fat in a single meal. And the thing that's amazing is that one single meal can make a difference in the endothelium, in the lining of the walls of the artery. You can make a change within 6 hours of somebody having a really fatty meal. And so my most important question was, how did you feel the next day? She said she could hardly get out of bed. So as long as we continue to look at cardiovascular disease as a plumbing problem, that somehow these pipes get clogged with excess cholesterol that's been floating around the bloodstream, and, you know, as long as we're taking that statin drug, and this is what she said. She says, well, I'm on a statin and I take an aspirin every day. You know, aspirin doesn't have any known effects, not any known effects on the modifiable risk factors of cardiovascular disease. Zero, none that have ever been proven. But the circumstances are that she was still dealing with the idea that as long as she was taking this statin drug and she was taking this aspirin, she could eat whatever she wanted. She could eat this New York strip steak and a baked potato with butter, sour cream, and bacon, and have a piece of cheesecake. So when we begin to look at cardiovascular disease as a plumbing problem and we leave off all the stuff about insulin resistance, we're going to lose. Because there is a critical balance that happens in the body. And that critical balance has to do with inflammation. We know now that inflammation causes heart disease. It isn't the cholesterol. And the inflammation is coming from that middle obesity. Inflammation is the enemy. And so when we see those changes begin to happen in the arteries, you know, even in the fetus, you know, if the mother has hypercholesterolemia, you know, we've got too high a cholesterol during the pregnancy, we get metabolic program. It was very interesting to find out that when pregnant mothers have too many calories in the first two trimesters, even if they eat normal calories in the third trimester, they program their baby to become a diabetic. If people have too little calories in the first two trimesters, even if they have too many calories in the last trimester, they don't program their baby to become a diabetic. And so maternal metabolic programming is an awakening arena around the health of our future generations. But even in childhood, we find fatty streaks. You know, the first time they studied this was when they started bringing the vets home from Korea back in the beginning of the 1950s, and they found out that 19-year-olds still had aortic fatty streaks. And so they couldn't believe it. And so they repeated those things years later with the Vietnam veterans, and they did autopsies on these apparently healthy young men. And they demonstrated up to 77% prevalence of atherosclerosis in their coronary arteries, and yet their average age was 22. And so in taking samples of carotid arteries from young people who died from accidents or tragically homicide or suicide, found there was a presence of these fatty streaks in their coronary arteries and their carotid arteries down to age 3. Aortic fatty streaks in a 3-year-old. Something's real wrong with what we're feeding our kids when their vascular age is more than quintuple what their actual age is. You know, your vascular age. Nobody ever asks you that. How old are you? How old are your blood vessels? Your vascular age, or the state of your arteries, is more important than your chronological age in terms of the evolution of cardiovascular disease. So the implications are grim. But what can you do about it? You know, here on No Nonsense Nutrition, I always try to talk to you about what can you do about it. Well, the first thing that you can do is move, move, move. We need to find a way to stay physically active on a very regular basis. We need to get rid of the sugar-sweetened beverages. It doesn't matter whether they're soft drinks or fruit drinks or punch or whatever you want to call them. If they are a sugar-sweetened beverage, you can bet that they're especially high in fructose, and you can bet they're going to contribute to insulin resistance. You know, one of the places that shows up on your blood work is when your uric acid starts to rise. So if you look at your blood work and you've got a high uric acid on your blood work, that's a flag. That's one of the early flags that is going to tell us that something's going on in terms of your blood work. Now, diet drinks may be a reasonable alternative to sugar-sweetened beverages because they have no calories, but they also provide no nutritional value. And we don't really know what the health consequences are of consuming these artificial sweeteners for a lifetime. We do know that aspartame has more complaints about it at the FDA than any other single nutrient. So if the choice is a regular sweetened soda or a diet sweetened soda, I'm going to have to pick the diet sweetened soda, even though I hate it. What I really want you to do is to have a glass of water and eat an apple. Have a glass of water and have an orange. I've got one of those nifty holiday clementines sitting in my car for me to have after the show is over. That way I'm getting the fiber with the sugar that's in the whole fruit. We need to look at the idea of getting more whole foods in the diet. You know, all I say is eat what occurs in nature. You don't need a PhD to tell the difference between a potato and a Pringle. You don't need a background in nutrition to tell the difference between a chicken and a chicken nugget. You know, the nature of sleep has such a component in virtually everything. You know, the average sleep time in the United States has been decreasing over the last 50 years until we're sleeping almost a year and a half less than we used to. And sleep loss is associated with cardiovascular disease, with obesity, with type 2 diabetes, with metabolic syndrome, because it alters normal cardiac function. It changes the stress response, and therefore it promotes a state of inflammation in the body. Sleep curtailment is a risk factor for chronic disease. And so, you know, go up on sleepfoundation.org if you need ideas how to get better sleep. You know, I do a lot of amino acid therapy to help people get better sleep. And sometimes simple things like 5-HTP and theanine are things that can help people sleep better, because diabetes leads to fatty liver, and fatty liver is also created with sleep apnea. You know, these repetitive episodes of upper airway obstruction that occur during sleep, especially when somebody's laying on their back and they snore loudly, and then you hear them gasp, because they're not getting enough air to the brain. That's not a good thing. So obstructive sleep apnea is definitely related to fatty liver, and definitely related to obesity, and definitely related to diabetes, and definitely related to heart disease. We need to get good sleep. It isn't just a matter of being in the bed 8 hours. It's a matter of really sleeping. And, you know, even though 85% of people do really well somewhere between 7 and 8 hours, There's about 10% of people that absolutely need 9, and there's about 5% of people who can get by on a little less than 7. But when people say, oh, I do fine on 5 hours of sleep, the stats don't agree with that. And when I find out what you're actually doing that's keeping you up that late, it's usually not anything worthwhile. There was a world before Facebook. So increase your fiber, get rid of those liquid calories, get some more lean protein, get rid of the trans fats and the saturated fats. You've heard that a lot here on No Nonsense Nutrition. Those are all things that you can do to improve your future, to give yourself a future. And so, yes, I'll have treats during the Christmas holidays. You can bet on it. I'm not asking you to abstain from everything. I'm asking you to think about your future and to figure out what kind of old person you want to be. I'd like to be an old person at some point. And in order for me to do that, I need to make better choices. Move, get sleep, eat whole foods, eat things close to the way they occur in nature, reduce the saturated fats, and stay the heck away from those New York strip steaks.